Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Castorbis podcast with a K, available on Castorbis.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. Okay, and you know, like now I'm going to say greetings, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Castorbis podcast with a K, even though that segment's completely pre-recorded. I don't need to say that anymore. But, you know, I might even start pre-recording this bit. With me are Brian Turnover and James McLean. I'm the editor, Christian Corley.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Which one, him?
Either. Well...
How about we pre-record these bits too? I'm
Why
fine.
Why don't we pre-record the whole podcast?
Done. I am fine. / a bit upset this week. / it's been an odd week, hasn't it?
And it's then you like writing a video game. Stop it.
Yes.
Okay, dear listener, you join us at a quite an insanely busy podcast. We wanted, just as an experiment, to stick the words missing episodes in the title, just to see what the reaction would be from our listeners, and whether or not we would quadruple our audience figures again. But we won't do that this time around, because we don't really have any missing episode stuff to talk about this week. What we do have to talk about is Brian's weekend at LI Who. We've got an interview with Gareth Cavana concerning the events in Manchester over the coming days in the run-up to the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who on the 23rd of November. And, of course, we've got our recommendations. We're also going to talk about the trailers and possibly someone's bastard offspring. But before that, we're planning a live podcast on the 24th of November. Are we all okay for that still?
Yeah, I think so.
James can keep himself awake until then.
I know, I can't.
So we are planning a podcast on the 24th of November, a live podcast on Google Hangouts. So we'll be advertising that on Twitter beforehand and on Facebook and on Castorbis. So you can join in. That's the day after the 50th anniversary episode airs. Obviously, the day of the Doctor should have just passed. So, and we'll all have been watching it in different ways. So that'll be an interesting... Brian will be watching it in America, for instance. James presumably will watch it on TV if he can keep his eyes open, and I'll be watching it at the cinema. So we'll have plenty to speak about the next day, and anything that you want us to talk about as well, you can just like messages on the day. And currently on Castorbis, we have some giveaways. You can win a TARDIS bathrobe this until the end of November. I believe that's available. And this week you can win a beautiful Dalek mug of a yellow submarine theme. Provided by Tone Cartoons. It's a lovely little mug. I like it. I like it a lot. So that's that. Which brings us to the end of our things I need to tell you before we carry on with the rest of the show. To the rest of the show. And the trailer. Or the trailers. Depends how you want to put it. I mean, it's two trailers, isn't it, really? Well, three trailers, because there was a sneak peek from the episode as well on Friday. Then we had, late on Friday, early on Saturday morning, a trailer went live. Might have had the hand forced by someone in Peru, or I think it was Peru. BBC in Peru leaked the trailer early, or released the trailer early. And we've got all these images from the Day of the Doctor. Stunning images from the Day of the Doctor, I might add. Brian, you were at a convention. How did you hear about the trailer?
Oh, my God. We actually were... At whatever point of the night, we were all just kind of like, okay, let's relax. We've been running ourselves ragged. We're just going to go sit down in the lobby. And one of our friends went back to the hotel room to do the same. And all of a sudden, we all get this mass text together, come to my room right now. And we're like, okay, something's going on. And then all of a sudden, like, all of our eyes kind of lit up. And we were like, oh, it can't be. And we just flew back there. And that was the leaked trailer.
Right.
So we actually saw that. That was Friday evening, I guess, is when that came out. And it was great. We enjoyed the heck out of that. And we did that thing where not only do you watch it, but you start trying to pause it randomly and just watch frame for frame the different things, especially since my one friend does an 11th Doctor cosplay and I do the 10th Doctor cosplay. And we just kept trying to figure out moments that we could recreate in photos throughout the weekend just from this one trailer alone. That was the excitement level after it.
You see, this is what I love about you Americana types, is that you just love things so much. If there's something you're passionate about, you just absolutely
love it,
suck it up, yeah, in a way that is disgusting, really. But it's at the same time, I'm jealous of it. I'm jealous of the way that you just all as a group just sort of come together in one big gelatine or gelotine or whatever you call it over there, and you just love it, and it's really kind of cool, and I sort of kind of like it, and as I say, I envy it at the same time. That's almost like a childish excitement that you carry with you, and I'm sure it's because you guys really do carry a lot more of your childhood with you than we do over here. I mean, looking at sort of the way you deal with Halloween, Christmas, and even Thanksgiving as well, there's a certain jubilation which I think sort of carries on, and it gives you sort of a more of an open vibrancy than I think that me and Christian have. Do you think, Christian? I mean, I'm not saying that we don't enjoy stuff. I'm not saying at all.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed the trailer. I've rewatched it several times. I have got rather excited about it. I mean, I suppose there was no group experience for me. I discovered it when I was waiting to go to bed. Basically,
we don't get the 4G, which obviously is a fan orgy combined into one clever McLean sentence. I quite like it. We don't get that sort of 4G that I don't think perhaps that sort of gestalt 4G. But yeah, it's
brilliant. No, we don't get that. What did you think of it, James? Anything stick out to you?
I liked this first one more than the second one. The second one was a bit more indulgent, I felt, that you did kind of...
40 seconds longer, the second one.
Yeah, I kind of felt a little overspoiled on the second one. I'm not sure I was as keen because it was giving me too much almost.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I was feeling like, no, I'm starting to feel like I'm getting too much out of this. The first one was good enough. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you go into something like this because you're looking for, you're excited about seeing how the doctors will interact. And in a way, the second trailer started to give you a little too much of it. Not the whole thing, but just a little too much. It spoilt me. I kind of thought, well, I'm excited about seeing this because I don't quite know how their chemistry is going to hit off. And it started to tell me. And I was like, oh, I wish you hadn't done that. But it was my fault for watching it. It's not. I thought it was good. Sorry.
That brings up a question for me. Since I was at the con and we didn't quite really get to watch like the actual released ones as they have been, was the one that was leaked the one that was actually originally supposed to air Saturday? Because the other one, the longer one, came out Sunday, right?
Yeah. It's all a bit confused, really.
Yeah, because otherwise, I mean, I kind of, in a sense, agree with you, James. Like, it did seem a bit too much at the time. Like, not that I'm complaining, because personally for me and everybody in my group, we adored it. We loved both of them. As a matter of fact, we went nuts over the second trailer. I can't tell you how many videos or photos we took trying to recreate parts of this trailer, which some of them were great. Like the moment when the doctors sit back, kick their legs up and cross their arms. We loved that moment. But the sense, though, that I had that it was maybe a tad too much was that we got two different trailers, completely different trailers, 2 days in a row. I had thought maybe if one had come out a week later or something, this way you had time to really relish the one that you had in the first place. I'm not going to complain, but I can see that kind of element, you know.
The general consensus is the one that came out first was Saturday's trailer, but it was released early. Now, if it was in Peru, then that kind of excuses it. Initially, I thought it was from Spain.
So did I, actually.
And it may well be from Spain, but the problem with it coming out early and not being a leak, there's this semantic argument over whether it was early or whether it was a leak. There's no time discrepancy between Madrid and London. They're both on the same time zone. And also, if there was a discrepancy, it wouldn't be a 30-minute discrepancy. It would be an hour discrepancy. So the person that leaked it, it was either done intentionally or the person is a moron. So, you know, you can take it either way. And then presumably the BBC, because they had said it was going to be on Saturday evening, so they obviously released it early across the world. So, hey, I'm not complaining.
Oh, no. So, we had wondered the same thing, though, to be honest.
Yeah. So, Brian, did you have any favorite moment?
Honestly, I think one of my favorite two favorite moments, I guess, that stuck out for me, really. And they were both like doctor related moments. I did really like the moment when Matt and David actually kicked back their legs and arms and set themselves in the chairs in that one scene. And the other one, I actually admit, probably the fangasm again for you there. I love the unison element to it. I loved it. It kind of showed like these guys are definitely indeed the same guy, you know, and some quirks are just going to stick around. The Patrick Troughton nod with the whole you've changed the council room, I don't like it. And the whole just cinematic, the gorgeous cinematic aspect of the trailer. If the trailer is, which it obviously is indicative of the story, it's going to be a beautiful thing to look at, I think.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. What about the Eighth Doctor bit? Have you spotted that?
No, I've heard people talking about it.
Yeah, so you'll need to hit, and you too, dear listener, you'll need to head to Facebook to have a look through the gallery of screenshots, which I lovingly prepared for both of you and for you, listener. I did it for you.
I know, and that's why we're lovingly having to find the link that you didn't send us and have to trudge through Facebook ourselves.
Basically, there is a figure that leads, that's apparently leading the Doctor and Clara into a room. And you see it from within the room, and you see the door opening up, and there's a silhouetted figure of the eighth, of what appears to be the Eighth Doctor.
Right, okay. I'm just trying to see if I can find...
The moment.
No, it's not the moment. That's a different thing. Well, look, while you're doing that, let's talk about Rose, or whoever she is.
I've got my theory there.
Yeah, TARDIS?
Which I don't know. It would be nice. No.
No.
I've had this theory for a while, and I may have mentioned it once or twice before, but I still kind of think that John Hurt is the Ninth Doctor, the original Ninth Doctor, but somehow doing whatever he does to save the universe, even with the help of Matt and David, who knows, his timeline gets erased, and Eccleston is the Ninth Doctor that we then know, or this Ninth Doctor was alive, and this Rose Tyler is indeed Rose Tyler. But she's the one that traveled with this Ninth Doctor. And it was kind of like they were somehow destined to always know each other in this ninth life of his. Right. It's a theory that I like and I hope for. I'm not entirely convinced of it, but the trailer really made it seem quite likely because she can still have the bad wolf element in her as it appears that she does. So I kind of liked that element. That's my theory. That's my kind of hope. I can
go with that theory, I think. Not that there's anything wrong with that theory. It's a very good theory.
Mm. Well, thank you.
It's interesting. It's interesting to see, for the perhaps, possibly, maybe, ultimately, with the exception of one other episode I'm trying to think of off the top of my head, which I can't think of the top of my head, but it was there. It's for the first time seeing Moffat actually recognizing the RTD era. You know, because it's clearly that he is really sort of embellishing on what Davis set up. I mean, the bad wolf factor seems to be very prevalent. It's in the posters as well, as you say, and obviously we've got the flashy eyes for Piper. We've got obviously the Tenedoff, we've got the Time War. It seems quite an open attempt to sort of embrace recent continuity. Well, Moffat's era has been largely up until perhaps the last season or so, being very clearly moving forward, as we've said before, than looking back.
Well, you can see why he wanted to take it in his own direction, don't you?
No, yeah, I'm not. It wasn't a criticism. Well, it was a bit at the time, but at the same time, I think you can see the argument for not doing so.
Yeah,
I think his argument was there's a sound sense to it in a certain aspect, and there's some classic fans will say there's a logic in the sense that Doctor Who has always been like that. But as I've always said, it's a new era. You've got a lot of new fans. I think it was quite a harsh. To ignore so much, but the fact he's doing it now, you know, who cares? I think it's right. I mean, a lot of people, because we had recently, didn't we? We had a little email discussion about this, and it wasn't just yourself who brought this up, but I saw this on another blog. The idea that that people were sort of kind of feeling that he was suggesting this wasn't a Ninth Doctor or an 8.5.
Yeah.
That this was actually someone else, and I'm still not sure I really agree with that. To me, everything still points to it being a post-McGann, but I get the impression what Moffat's been saying of late is that this is a fully fledged Doctor who's had a long time, a long life, who's got old. He's not like someone who's just appeared, you know, McGann's been in the Time War and suddenly he's popped up at the end and done something naughty. He's had a life as the Doctor as long as any other Doctor.
Which is why I really do like the theory, like I was saying, that he is a Ninth Doctor, proper Ninth Doctor. He had a whole life of his own and then gets wiped out, which is also, if you look at his console room, it looks like the Eccleston tenant room, just with a new floor, kind of more corroded columns and different lights in the console, you know, and there may be a slightly different shape to the frame of the console, but it looks like they're really trying to set up that kind of element, like a parallel kind of element to Eccleston. Because I know a lot of people say there's Eighth Doctor elements in his clothes, but I always felt it was more Ninth Doctor just in the jacket alone, whereas the other clothes look more piratey to me than they ever looked like the Eighth Doctor's clothes.
Yeah, so
I'm still hoping he is actually the Ninth Doctor, and it is not a parallel as you're saying, but he's actually the Ninth Doctor, which makes McGann technically the Tenth. But given this one's taken his title away, Eccleston still remains the Ninth Doctor because this one has no title.
The reason I don't think that would be, though, is because BBC has so much money in marketing, advertising them as the 10th and the 9th and the 11th, that they're not going to allow that to happen.
They're still the same because he's written out the get-out clause. Because even if they sort of vaguely acknowledge him as a doctor in this episode, he was still removed because he is, as they very clearly said in the last episode, in the name of the doctor, he does not have the title of the doctor. He is not the doctor. In fact, even in this whole trailer, he even has the opportunity, we don't know the context, but to sort of say, I am looking for the doctor, almost sounds like he could be acknowledging the fact that he knows he lacks that
title.
You mean
the lame get-out clause, of course.
Well, it depends on what you want. I mean, he said Moffat sort of started to build a case for this in recent interviews where he sort of said that basically Doctor Who is a show that lies to you because we can keep reinventing it. That there is no set continuity because we can turn around and say, yeah, but you didn't know this was happening at X point. Because at the time, no one had decided that. But retroactively, it's a show where you can do a lot of retconning. And I think he's setting this up. And I don't think he's going to want to. He seems the sort of guy to me, Moffat, that he likes to establish things. He doesn't like vagueness. He has created a new doctor. So why the hell make him a doctor which is almost like an nth doctor, who is a parallel doctor? Why not? He's striking me at the moment of sort of saying, I like this idea of having a doctor that we just didn't know about. So I think you're going to find that he is reestablishing continuity. And as Brian has said in the past, there is an argument that perhaps isn't actually his mandate as a producer to be so busy changing continuity, but it's what he seems to do. So I think you might have to suck up the fact that this is going to be the new Ninth Doctor, which makes Eccleston the Tenth.
Because it's a shame, though, because that idea to me is far less interesting than this alternate reality idea. I actually think it's much more clever to give us this. We always see in Doctor Who that time is actually in flux, that because, you know, the year 2000 is completely different when Zoe lived in it than when it's actually shown in the show or any time after it is shown in the show, you know. So we constantly can see that there are some things that are set in stone. They will not change fixed points in time. And there are things that are in flux. But to think that the Doctor's life could also somehow have been in flux is very interesting, and it's far more interesting to me than thinking there's just this version of the Doctor that you never got to see just because, you know,
I think the presence of Rose, it pushes the balance, tips the balance more towards Brian's.
Oh, I see. I disagree, because I think that the fact that this is the 50th and the fact that there's been a lot of word coming out from the production, that there's a lot of changes this year, I think this is why it's happening. I think he's decided that the 50th is a good excuse to do something really retroactive, to give the actual 50th a special moment. And I really do think this isn't going to be a parallel, because it's been done in too much. Sci-fi has done too many alternate variations, which are a very nice way of doing something interesting and then locking them out and sort of saying, this hasn't changed anything, we can move forward. I think Moffat's a game. We know from his personality, he's a game changer.
I have to disagree with that, because Moffat has been the king so far of borrowing ideas. So why stop now?
Well, but then Moffat is someone who likes to change stuff. He loves to retroactively change and reestablish continuity. He's been doing it a lot of late. I see no logic at all. And to be honest, as I say, personally, and this is where we obviously both disagree, I think it is far more interesting to have, and it is a borrowed idea if he does do this, because, I mean, this whole idea of as we've said before in this podcast, of a doctor which is spurned from the other was done in the New Adventures. It was done with the Seventh Doctor. It was very clear that they were the Room with No Doors was a coffin for the Seventh Doctor for his crimes, which this is almost an identical idea. So I agree, it is another borrowed idea, but I really think he's not going to want to have this taken away and pigeoned as an nth doctor almost.
I think he's going to want to do it. Because, like you just said, he likes to rewrite history. And if you look at what he did, he rewrote the original. He rewrote the first Doctor getting the TARDIS twice now, even though one was by Neil Gaiman, it was in his era. And he rewrote other things as you go along. But now you said, oh, it's interesting to see him paying a nod to the Russell T. Davis era. Is he paying a nod? Because it looks to me that he's removing Paul McGann and Christopher Eccleston from the Time War and giving us John Hurt. So he's already rewriting Russell's vision.
I think, yes. I think you're right. I think he is rewriting it. I just don't think... he just doesn't seem to be the type to do something half-assed at this moment. For good or bad, he is a very arrogant man. He's a very arrogant writer.
I will say the trailer looks fantastic, and it does look like he may have stepped up his A game, so I can agree with you on that. And I guess we'll find out. Like, I can't say my
I'm kind of glad
we're
having this, because to me, watching the trailer, to me, it was kind of, for me personally, my perspective, it seemed to reinforce everything I thought was going to happen, with the exception of the Rose factor, which I could see being put in there anyway, because there was a suggestion from the Rose that there was a connection, that Bad Wolf might have a further connection. But I'm kind of glad we're having this, because it gives me an idea to be looking for other things. Do you know what I mean? It's not taken my opinion away, but it's given me something to talk about and to challenge it, which is pretty cool.
And there's even the element that we... forgotten, which is the Zygon. You know, like, how do they actually play into all of this? You know, it would be kind of weird to bring back Billie Piper and have her be a Zygon, but at the same time, it would be something that most people aren't expecting, because they're just expecting to see Rose again.
I'm a bit worried about the Zygon, actually. I'm worried that there's two ways this could go. One, that it could be a very sort of lame appearance, because this isn't a very long episode, so I'm not quite sure how they're going to wedge a Zygon in. So the Zygon's either going to have too little relevance, or quite frankly, too much relevance, because while the Zygon were interesting, they're not exactly the biggest threat in the universe. And we're talking Time War and Daleks and stuff here. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with that, whether it's going to feel a bit of a wasted or damn squib. What do you guys have any worries
about? I felt exactly the same.
I think they're linked. I think we see evidence of Zygons in both Doctor's adventures prior to the meeting. So I suspect they might be linked in some way.
It's just a very odd character creature to bring back for the 50th of all of them. I'm not against it. I like Zygons, but you know, when you've got Time Wars and universe apocalyptic stuff, the Zygons seem somewhat, I don't know, like caretakers.
Then again, they might have been involved. We don't know.
They could have been. They could have been.
Well, that's an interesting idea.
Shapeshifting could have been useful.
Yeah, could have been. Yeah. You don't know. And I mean, close appraisal.
We do know so little.
Yeah, a close perusal of the images shows that someone's been keeping tabs on the Doctor. Because there's shots in what's presumably a unit HQ room of lots of publicity photos from Doctor Who over the years, including Ace and Bambira and Sarah Jane from Pyramids of Mars.
Oh, was that? I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I've just found your McGann little moment on the Casterbrus
Facebook page.
Which is great, just as Stitch Trap and all that stuff is, which I know we've gone through. But it does look a little McGann-y. It could be.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I saw someone mention
it may have been Kate Stewart.
It could be.
It did kind of have her shape, but it does look like McGann's shape as well, which, you know, I still hold that hope. So,
especially since you've got a room with all these, what looks like, I don't know, maybe
statues or bodies,
doctors. Well, that's exactly where I think everyone was kind of thinking. Likewise, it could be something to do with Zygons, you never know. But that's an interesting and is that a vortex manipulator we see on
Clara's wrist?
Yes,
it might be.
It looks like it's huge on her wrist. That's the one thing we all noticed. Now, I understand it's only tiny. She's really small, but my God, that thing is gigantic.
Well, I mean, you know, we know obviously that Jack Harkness is not in the 50th episode, thanks to John Barrowman telling us what's it. It's been 3 or 4 times this year as he came out with that same statement that he'd be very happy to have been in it, but it sadly isn't. But then there was that talk, wasn't there, very early on that he would be, wasn't there? Wasn't it him and... Louise Jameson, who, do you remember, was sort of making those nods about some sort of relevancy, and then they had to shut up sort of very early in the year.
Yes.
Maybe, who knows? Maybe they'll do a bit that ends up on one of those computer screens Christian's talking about. Maybe that's as far as their relevance will go.
Maybe they're...
It is very interesting that we've got... as you say, Rose, and no shots of Rose so far with... the other doctors,
yeah,
apart from her.
Yeah.
Though I'm sure there was a pre-publicity, you know, one of those location shots which had her and Tennant together. So.
No, I don't think there was. I think there was a read-through. There was a read-through shot of her, Tennant, Joanna Page, and Matt Smith, and no, in fact, Billy Piper wasn't in the read-through.
Well, there was a location shooting on the Saigon set where everybody thought that someone wearing a purple hat was Billy Piper, but
yes,
it was off in the distance so far. It was right. There was no way you could actually make out that it was her face.
Is this the same Billy Piper who appeared in The Runaway Bride as well? On the rooftop scene.
Oh, right, yes, I see what you
remember
mean.
That, Brian?
No, I don't.
Yeah, but there someone took a photograph of, you know, the scene between the Doctor and Donna on top of the building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In The Runaway Bride near the beginning. And someone took a photo from a distance of it while it was shooting, and there was a figure behind them that looked like Billy Piper, but clearly just some production stuff or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, going by the outfit that she's even wearing, it's very likely that this is the same one that was in the Christmas Invasion, who just happens to be a stagehand that looks similar. But no, I mean, the picture that I'm talking about, I have to look for that Christmas, the Runaway Bride one. I didn't know about that. I can't believe I never heard of that one.
Yeah.
The one I'm talking about, it was over a hill, and all you saw were the top of their heads from a distance.
Right.
You know, but everybody was like, it's Billy Piper. She wore a purple hat in New Earth.
Come in a rose bush.
Okay. Yes, exactly.
Okay, right. Well, I'll tell you what we'll do.
Just out of interest, do you think if Rose isn't with the Doctors, do you think that's going to be a big disappointment for a lot of people? Because, I mean, I'm not a massive Rose fan, but there are a lot of Rose fans out there, you know, Rose and Tennant fans.
Couldn't give a damn for them, frankly.
Yeah, you know, I think it all depends on how it's handled, in my opinion, because I think there will be some people who want to see her one more time again with David Tennant. However, for myself, I am really liking the way the trailer is setting this up, because I like the fact that, you know, Rose got locked away and she already came back, you know, and we don't need to keep seeing her come back, in my opinion. And not that I don't want to see her again. I actually am quite excited that she's in the trailer, but I like the fact that they're doing something different is the way it seems.
I'm excited.
So I'm more happy about that.
Is that, I haven't seen War Machines in ages. That's not Wotan, is it, the background of that, shot of the room in unit.
I think it might be
with the two doctors, as you said.
I think it might be. Right. Looking at? Where they're sitting in the chairs.
Yes, the 50. It's screen cap 50 out of 84 guys out there. Well, how the hell have they got a picture of Chameleon? That's ridiculous. I'm just trying to think. Where the hell would they've got a picture of Chameleon? I mean, it looks like a King's Demons picture as well, so it must be a pretty old photo, that.
Why would we even need a picture of Chameleon?
Maybe the Master supplied it.
Maybe so, of course. That's the answer. And those guns are familiar. I wish, you know, some prop guys will tell me what they were, but there's the gun behind Tennant's head's very familiar, and I can't think what it's from.
Yeah, but what about the other thing? Why is there two, apparently, Kate Stewarts in this shot?
Well, that's what I'm saying earlier about Zygons.
Could be Zygons.
That makes a lot of sense. It does look like both of them are being very showy here for a reason.
It could be a very cool thing where, because there's two doctors there, that they're in the two same timeline, that it's a conversation with the same character in two different time streams. But I think that would be way too complex. But
I wouldn't put it past Moffat, to be honest with you.
Actually, no, I probably wouldn't. Yes, you're quite right. But yes, you're totally right. It's a great trailer. I think it's going to be a very special Doctor Who episode. I don't think there's any doubt of that. It's a shame there's no Eccleston. Be interesting if there's a bit of McGann. It'll be interesting if there's a few surprises that they've managed to keep secret from.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pleased if they have.
Me too.
Okay. Oh, Brian, before we finish, the screwdriver that Tennant's holding.
That is an MFX sonic screwdriver, yes.
Right, okay. Because I was going to say, but wasn't... Because didn't his have a grey mottle to his?
Well, no.
Yellow.
Here's what happened. Millennium FX, who is the company, of course, that worked on the show doing the Monster FX makeup and David Tennant's old age makeup and so on, the Davros makeup, you know, the lots of iconic things, got the license in 2008 or 9 to make replicas of the sonic screwdriver. Mm-hmm. They made this version, and what happened was they came out with these yellow handles, which unfortunately for Neil Gorton got torn apart by the fan community because everybody said the handle should be gray, which rightly so, it should have been gray. But now, after all these years, after it had been torn apart, David ended up using one in the 50th anniversary, which now has apparently made this replica now a screen-accurate item, probably the most screen-accurate Sonic screwdriver you can get. Because, you know, if you bought one, you own one. It's the same thing he's holding. The question is, though, we know David Tennant has one of his, and he lent it to the wand company to digitally scan to make their universal remote. So the question is, was this filmed while that was on loan? Like, how did this come to be? Or was it just that was kind of beaten too far to use on screen that they went to the Millennium FX because they were already pre-made, you know? Either way, personally, I'm really happy because I own an MFX Sonic as well as other replicas, which I adore, like my CT Sonic.
Well, the replicas and the are available. Sonic.
Yes, exactly. But just knowing that this one now was actually used, it makes my MFX feel a little bit more special to me. As well, I've always loved it, but it makes it feel more special to me. So
your wand is special to you, is it?
Yes, it is. Well, you know, there's a lot of history behind it for me, including how I actually ended up being able to obtain one. But just knowing that it was made by the Millennium FX crew, who actually worked on the show, you know, whatever flaws people pick it apart for, I can live with, because when you look at the base shape of it, you know, like, those flaws aren't as apparent. Even though I'm a very screen accurate kind of guy, as you guys know, when it comes to my props, there's something just about it, since it came so close to the production team, that I've always just had a close held it close to my heart, I guess, you know.
Please tell me we are talking about his screwdriver.
I was going to say my wand was made by nature, and
we're
I was
talking about his too. Screwdriver.
It's crazy,
all right,
to have this. How much attention on his wand? I never got this sort of attention.
Well, there you go. Right, let's move on then to Anthony Coburn's son, who has kind of upset a lot of people over this weekend. Let's get the first bit out of the way. He's basically taken out an action against the BBC, saying that his father invented the TARDIS and that he wants royalties backdated to 1977 when his dad died. This is Steph Coburn, who's the son of Anthony Coburn, who wrote 100,000 BC and wrote various elements of Doctor Who's initial mythology in the opening episode. Now, there is problems with his claim. TARDIS was already invented. There is plenty of documentary evidence from the 1960s covering the genesis of Doctor Who. So whether or not he has a case or not, it should be pretty easy to establish. Of course, it didn't help his case that he said that... that's what he says is, it is by no means my wish to deprive legions of Doctor Who fans, brackets, of whom I was never one, close brackets, of any aspect of their favourite children's programme. That is why we're annoyed, Coburn, because you called Doctor Who a children's programme. Your father was not working for the children's department. He was working for the drama department.
Yeah.
But yes, it is a spurious claim, but these things all concern characters. The TARDIS isn't a character, is it? Oh dear. Maybe the TARDIS is a character. Maybe he has got a case. None of us are lawyers. So whatever you hear from us in the next few moments is not necessarily legal or accurate in a court of law. What do you think, Brian?
What do I think? I think I know nothing of these matters. All I know is I like the TARDIS. I'm happy to have it.
Okay. Yeah. James?
I don't know. I mean, as I say, it's one of those sort of things which, as you say, quite seriously, just falls down into legal question of evidence and relevance and all the stuff that we've got no real privilege to see what the claim's based on. I imagine there's got to be more than just an inkling to try and take on one of the most established copyrights of a corporation, which is not an easy. I don't think any legal rep's going to sort of want to do that without anything quite substantial to back it up. So I don't know. I'd thought it's unlikely. Even if there was truth in it, I would say his chances are probably going to be very slim, given the amount of time, the establishment, and I don't know. I'd be very surprised. But
I would as well. In fact, to be honest with you, I think the Davros guy's got more chance of winning.
Or, you know, Tony Hancock's estate over Terry Nation. You know, there's all these sort of things. The problem with creativity, especially when it's a production,
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not a single person's authorship.
Yes.
It becomes very hard. So whether or not he is justified or not, I cannot say, but I imagine he's going to have a hard time proving it after 50 years. I was just thinking, oh, God, 1963, how many years is it since 1963? I've got to work out how many years it is to say, yeah, no, 50, yeah, I wonder. But yeah, it's 50 years. In case you hadn't noticed this, it's actually 50 years this year.
Of what?
1963.
Of Doctor Who?
No, JFK.
Oh, right, Australia. Of course. Oh, yes,
good
right.
Lord, yeah, that means Doctor Who as well is 50 this year.
Yeah. And if just in case of spoilers, the wife did it. All right. So let's push on. That's Anthony Coburn's son out of the way. Brian, you've had a busy weekend, haven't you?
Very busy, yes.
Yeah. This podcast never ends.
That's right. That's what we'll call it. The podcast that never ends.
What did you do the weekend then, Brian?
I was a guest at LA Who, Long Island Doctor Who convention, which was the first of its kind over November 8th to the 10th. And there I did a whole selection of things. You know, I was very busy. I did 7 panels, including one for my own film series, Legacy. Fan film series Legacy, and then I got to interview a couple of the actors, Simon Fisher-Becker, Ian McNeice, and Sylvester McCoy. Also got to spend a little bit of time with Fraser Hines, not interviewing him, but I got to get a photo with him, and then I got to chat with him a little bit, where I introduced him to my girlfriend, who did not get to be there for the photo, and he tried to get me in trouble by telling her, oh, I guess I shouldn't tell you about those two blondes that he was with the other day then. Thanks, Fraser. Thanks, man. That was very fun. He's a very cheeky guy.
He is, isn't he?
Oh, God, yeah. He's hilarious.
Did you sort of try and kill the moment by showing him your screwdriver?
You know, okay, you know what? When I went in for a photo with him, he stopped. He was starting to say something, and then he stopped, and he grabbed the lapel of my tenant suit. And he said, oh, this is a very fine replica. This is gorgeous. He said, did you have this made? And he said, even down to the stitching, this looks beautiful. And I told him I did have it. He said, did you have it made in England or something? And I think I told him, you know, I had it made in New Zealand, and that the person who created it actually even recreated the fabric based off of the same Gap pants that Tennant used. And he was just very taken with the suit. I mean, he was very into that. And we had taken one photo together, both he and my friend and I. And we were just standing there smiling. And then he just turned to me after the picture and he said, you know, you're David Tennant. We should do a Tennant pose, shouldn't we? And I said, I think we should. So I actually handed him my sonic screwdriver and we did a David Tennant pose. And it's a fantastic moment. It was my birthday that day. And that was such an awesome birthday gift. You know what I mean? So it was such a great thing and a great moment to just get to goof off with him for a little bit. It was really nice.
Did you say to, I mean, my brain, I'm sorry, I mean, I call you lot childish, but my brain's been carry on overdrive ever since sort of mention of the word screwdriver. But putting the phallic jokes aside, did you ask him if anything ever funny happened on set with kilts or
I did not. No, here's the thing. I didn't get to. I really wanted to interview him. And the moment that my chance to interview him had come up, one of his TV interviews showed up and he was late with doing something else. So I was told I could interview him while the TV crews were setting up, but unfortunately the timing didn't work out. So I didn't get to actually ask him any proper questions, just got to goof off with him a little bit, I guess. So no, unfortunately I didn't get to ask him anything. I wanted to ask about the lost episodes and so on, or the found episodes rather. And, but you know, it was so much fun. What was
that's good.
So you also spoke to Simon Fisher-Becker.
Yes. Simon was fantastic. He was so nice. He was my first interview. And so that everybody out there knows, I actually wasn't aware coming into this convention that interviews was something that I was able to do. You know, it was hopeful, but at the moment I didn't know. So we didn't really prepare any questions as we ordinarily would do, because I was essentially there as a panelist for Casterbrus.com. I didn't know that I was able to do the interviews until I showed up that day. And within 2 hours of showing up, they said they were going to have interviews. So I sat down with Simon and I laid it out for him. I let him know, listen, I wasn't prepared for this. I didn't know. I don't really have any questions. So I'd just like to have a conversation if we could. At the end of the interview, which was great, he had said to me that it was one of the most pleasant interviews that he had ever had, because rather than just sitting there answering questions for somebody, we got to have a lovely conversation. And then he told me, find him on Facebook. So I did. And I sent him a message thanking him again for the interview, to which he replied once again that it was a very pleasant and lovely interview. And then the next day, he was telling people, because the day after the interview was my birthday, he was telling a few people when he would see me, he kept saying happy birthday to me, and then he would turn to other people and say, it's his birthday, say happy birthday. That means he stalked my Facebook profile, which is awesome. You know, it was very nice, because the guy, one of the guys who ran the con, Ken Deep was there, and Simon was going in for breakfast, and he said, hello, Simon. And Simon just looked at me and said, oh, it's the birthday boy. Ken, say happy birthday to the birthday boy. He didn't even acknowledge Ken at first, which is not to be rude. I mean, obviously they were all very friendly, and Ken's a really lovely guy, but I thought that was great that my birthday kind of sidestepped that moment for a second there. So that was very nice. That was really, really kind of like made my day type moment.
And how old were you, Brian?
38.
38.
Yeah.
And you know what I did on my
38
birthday?
Going on 5 at that moment, you know?
Yeah, I bet.
I sat here on my birthday.
Did
you? I sat here on my birthday and did one of these bloody podcasts while you on your birthday get to schmooze and expose yourself with these euphemisms of screwdrivers. And then people laugh and are your friends and they give you birthday greetings and check your Facebook profile. And you were 38 as well. I mean, in the end, you know, when we're going to be up at the pearly gates, we'll be talking to St. Peter and Jesus and those guys, and they'll be saying, oh, you know, what was your 38th birthday like? I mean, I suppose Jesus won't be talking about that particularly, but, you know, you put the us to it. But, you know, we'll be like saying, hey, well, you know, he'll look at mine and my birthday, he'll be bored to tears. Yours? He might be slightly impressed because not only, you know, did you have a nice time, you know, you are genuinely a good guy and he likes good guys.
Well, thank you. I hope one day that Jesus is actually asking me about my 38th birthday along with you. I'm sorry that you didn't have a very
like
enjoyable
38th.
But hey.
I didn't say he would say that. So that wouldn't be very impressive, would it? But he might. It was the context of the story. I didn't think it through.
Brian, Sylvester McCoy.
Sylvester McCoy.
Yes.
Absolutely a genuine.
No, Sylvester McCoy recognized you.
No, he didn't. He didn't recognize me. I let him know. I told him that we had met him at Dimensions in Stockholm. He's in, what was that, 2006?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and I had told him, I said, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the Big Finish radio dramas, and I said, you were just absolutely lovely to me, and I just wanted you to know that, and he was very appreciative of that. So he didn't recognize me, he was really...
He thought you were David Tennant. He's getting
no, no. Not... I wasn't... Okay, when I did the interviews, I was not in my cosplay. I did not dress up in my costume because I didn't think I could do that or should do that. But when I did get my picture with Fraser, I was in my costume.
Okay, dear listener, you may want to rewind as well. I'm going to have to, so I can repicture everything in my head with Brian not dressed as David Tennant.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to do considering these days I seem to be dressed like him more often than not. but he was very nice. We had a great conversation. I found out he's a history buff. I found out that apparently Paul McGann is really not that much taller than him and that they had to stand him on a crate for that famous photo of Sylvester handing over the Tardisky to him. And I was like, really? Like, is that the American aspect of filmmaking, do you think? And he felt that it was probably the exact same American execs wanting him to look a bit more heroic.
How did you find... I mean, obviously, we will eventually get to hear how you found him.
Yes.
Was this audio, wasn't it? So we'll in the future. But because he always seems quite an interesting character to me, because he seems naturally quite eccentric, but not in that sort of Tom Baker boisterous eccentric. It seems to be sort of introverted, almost slightly not nervous eccentricity, but sort of quite a personal one. Was that prevalent?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. He was very. He would tell a story, and then, you know, there's always that kind of little gag or joke that he wants to twist at the end or a moment, or he wants to tell a story. Like, for instance, he was telling me a story about how Russia, and I want to say, oh, I can't remember, another country, and unfortunately I'm forgetting which one, but there was during one of the wars, there was this peace treaty that was signed. And, you know, he was trying to tell me, because he found this a fascinating aspect, that this one country did not sign the peace treaty. So apparently this country and Russia have been at war for the past 40 years because they just did not sign this treaty. But nobody knew about it. you know, Russia, and they didn't know about it. So they've been at war, but they just didn't know they were at war. And, you know, he was obviously telling that story because it was just a funny aspect. And those are the beautiful moments that you get about him. Rather than sitting there going, oh, he's telling me this interesting bit about history, that's fascinating, he was telling you because isn't this hilarious? I think it's hilarious, you know. And he was full of moments like that where he would just come out with a silly quip or a silly little nod to something. But we also had a lot of genuine moments where we were talking about the big Finnish plays, and I was giving him my thoughts on a particular aspect of his character and how, you know, somehow it melded into two of us talking about it. It would be really great to see Sylvester's doctor make some kind of significant change to history, say, like, you know, stopping the assassination of President Kennedy, because it was a book that he was reading at the time, and making the world, or the U.S. at least, a better place through having him still as the president. And then having the Time Lords come in and take away all this planning and this plotting that the Seventh Doctor had done, you know, and making him revert it back and showing this turmoil that the character is going through because he's done this fantastic thing, but now he's being forced to undo it. And I thought, I was like, why have you not pitched this idea to Big Finish? And he said, you know, he said, you're right. I think I should. I think they would listen to me. I said, they would absolutely listen to you. Like, please pitch this. I would love to hear this story. So there were great moments like that without having questions to go through. We just sat there almost as if we were both two fans having just a great conversation about the show and about life in general. And so, yeah, he was very genuine and very pleasant. I didn't get a sense that it was just, let me get this interview over and go.
On your birthday.
This was the day before my birthday.
Oh, it's the day before your birthday. Good.
Yeah, this was Friday. Yeah, sorry. Don't you can take solace.
Well, I'm really pleased about that because McCoy, to me, I mean, I think people don't really think about it this way, but I mean, everyone always calls Baker, you know, the eccentric, but he strikes me as possibly being the only, maybe possibly the only other, what I would deem an eccentric, person, actor. Like Baker. The others seem to be quite sort of straightforward. I don't want to say normal people because they're not, because every doctor, to imbue a doctor, you've got to have a certain amount of quirk. But he always struck me as being in that sort of line like Baker, not obviously to the extent of Baker, though, where there was a sort of an unusual eccentricity about him that just you couldn't quite pin down.
Well, I think John Pertwee's quite eccentric as well, wasn't he? Just in a very different way.
Well, I've got the impression Pertwee was more sort of an actor eccentric. He was a sort of very loud, powerful actor in that sort of theatre eccentric way.
Right.
But McCoy strikes me as being in that sort of odd eccentric way, in the same way that I think Baker's not eccentric in that sort of theatrical actor way, even though there is a theatric to him. I don't think anyone would sort of, Baker's one of those,
I do agree with that. Because Tom Baker, you know, one thing I was saying this con during a Fourth Doctor panel was, is that Tom Baker, I think, basically without people to surround him would probably shrivel and die. You know, like the more people around him, the more people he can entertain, the more he lights up and the more his stories become something just completely unimaginable that you have to wonder if any aspects of them are true. You know, he's got that eccentricity with his storytelling. And I think Sylvester, I agree, has that. But in a different sense, like he can tell stories that have a quippy, silly nod to them. But I think part of his eccentricities is also that he will be goofy at any moment during an interview. He has no qualms about looking serious or you know, however, you know, many people want to have this air about them that, like, I'm this suave, sophisticated guy. But Sylvester just is a genuine, awesome, funny guy. And, you know, he'll do silly voices. He'll do silly sound effects or whatever. And it's very eccentric because I can't imagine John Pertwee or somebody doing those types of moments.
But then I suppose he comes from a very different background so far as from an actor than, say, John Pertwee came from. I mean, you've got a guy who, you know, not many people learn the spoons for a start. You know, there's a certain edge to his performance and his character, which I think is naturally there before, you know, even got to being a doctor. And that's what I always loved about his doctor when he started to really become his own person was you felt them come out. Those tiny things, which I know some people don't like, but things like the sleight of hand with the card, the use of the umbrella, the way he would use it to sort of push his leg in the opposite direction, or you know, the spoons, it sort of just gave him a sort of real sort of a sort of vibrancy. And watching him again, going on to recommendations, watching him again, he does remind me a lot that, you know, there's some doctors which become doctors in their own right because they're powerful characters like Tom Baker and John Pertwee. Here, watching him, I can sort of see the Hartnell in him and yet the eccentricity of him himself. There's a it's an interesting thing. We've said this before, and you watch Doctors, if you can actually see the connections within their personalities. And, you know, perhaps we've lost a bit of that with the new retellings, perhaps a little.
Perhaps. Maybe, which we'll see. Can we move on to Ian McNeice? Yeah. So you also spoke to Winston Churchill.
Yes. He was very nice. And, you know, I spoke to him a little bit about acting technique as well, to the point where I was very curious by this point, learning lines, especially since the way he had kind of described it to me, actually the way both Simon and he had explained it to me, you can go in for an interview or an audition, rather, for a part on Thursday that they need to fill by a Saturday. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, he says, I don't know why they always leave things so late. This was actually Simon saying this part. But, you know, then you have, like, no time at all to learn your lines. So I was speaking with Ian a little bit about learning lines, and I was saying, how do you do it? Like, I know you're a pro by this point, and you've been doing it so long, but how do you learn lines in such a short amount of time? And he was giving me some great ideas about, like, when you get a script, he would say that, actually, it was a girlfriend of his at the time who had suggested writing them down. And I found that very fascinating, because the more that you write something, the more you're doing it, the more thought process you're putting into it, the more familiar you become with it. And I thought, that's absolutely brilliant. That, and he also told me something I did not know, was that he has a stammer, or he had a stammer. And there were a couple acting jobs where he just physically could not say the lines. And he actually would try to get them to change them or get somebody else to say them. And at one point he was doing this commercial, which you'll hear in the interview, but he was doing this commercial, and he had actually offered, he had two lines, one he could say, one he couldn't. And he had offered to have, because he noticed there was a loudspeaker within the commercial as well, he offered to have one of his lines said by somebody else over the loudspeaker, and that he would take half the pay for his gig.
Yeah.
And he said the director of that piece said, you know what, we will have somebody else say it over the loudspeaker, but by no means are you getting half the pay. And, you know, there was that genuine aspect of him trying to really do a compromise that would benefit everybody in his mind. And it turned out to completely actually benefit everybody in the end, so much so that that director hired him later for another role because of how much he liked working with him. And so it was really great to find out all these different types of, like, inside scoops and so on. And I even found out from him, like, you know, it's funny, you think there's a difference between filming things in the UK and filming things in America, like the American film crews versus the UK film crews. Because, mm-hmm. you know, especially knowing how the BBC was in the 60s and the 70s when the, you know, 10 o'clock would hit and the lights went out, you know. But I said to him, what's the main difference? And he said, money. He said, the only difference is money. He said, Americans will pay you better. And he said they will also feed you better. He said you get craft tables at American shoots, where he said British ones you get tea and maybe biscuits. I found those things interesting, because I would have thought somehow, some way, there would have been film technique differences, and maybe there are. But to an actor who's done both, that was what he had found.
Tea and maybe biscuits.
But right, exactly. As a matter of fact, I think that's how he put it. Yeah. So.
That's a disgrace. Okay. Right, yeah. Well, let's wrap up your recollections. I know you have another interview. You spoke to John Peel as well.
Yeah. Well, John Peel I did a panel with.
Yeah. Okay.
I do want to say one thing. You were talking about the eccentricities and the entertainment aspect of these actors. And I want to say one of my absolute favorite moments with Frasier was one that I was in the room with him. I was right behind him when he was doing this. But, you know, he's such a playful guy. You know, I already told you how he essentially ratted me out to my girlfriend. But, you know, he did this thing where he takes a teacup and he holds a saucer and he slots a spoon through the teacup handle and holds the actual handle with his thumb. This way he can walk up to somebody, pretend to trip and flip the teacup, but it won't go anywhere. It'll just dangle on the spoon end. And they flip out thinking that, you know, tea is going to get spilled all over them. Why I love this moment so much is because for years at every wedding I ever attended for my family, my great uncle Naps did that gag to everybody. And watching Frasier do that brought back that memory to me, and it made me realize, my God, this man, he would fit in with my family so well. Like, he's so playful. Like, there was not a moment where he was talking to somebody where he just seemed like, yeah, let's just talk business, let's get down to this. No, he was goofy the entire time. It was so much fun watching him do what he does. So that was one of my great recollections.
I like also the fact that you just pointed out there that he ratted you out, which of course infers that his comments about the two girls was true.
Okay, I'm not letting Ariel listen to this podcast.
She's sat next to you, isn't she?
She's in the other room, quite possibly able to hear this.
Packing her bags.
We're going to pretend that she can't write, probably.
Yes, she had a glass up to the wall.
Yes. Okay. A big vase in her hand waiting for you.
But John Peel, absolute joy in a panel. He does not feel that he needs to be the center of attention. He does not feel in any way being on the panel with all these amateur writers or amateur podcasters or fan site people. He did not feel in any way that he should be the voice in the room. He was very interested in your opinion. He had very great opinions. He spoke very candidly about how or why he wrote the books that he wrote. And actually, I am going to go get some of his books now because I feel like a bit of a fool not having read them after all this time, after hearing so much about them now, and just how pleasant he was. I sat right next to him. We had a great conversation during the panel, and I just really was very impressed by him overall with his showmanship, you know, with his friendliness.
Okay, well, that is, you spoke to four people over the weekend.
Yes.
We've got recordings of all of them. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. We've also got, I'm delighted to say, we have got permission from Andrew Smith and Bernard Padden, who played Tylos in Full Circle, which Andrew Smith obviously wrote. When I chatted with them both at the Las Ogari earlier this year, we can use that in a future podcast as well. So, dear listener, we're going to be bringing something to you in the next few weeks of bumper interviewing quality. Well, the responses will be quality, perhaps not the questions, certainly in my case, anyway. But before that, we have an interview now. Last Thursday, unfortunately, I couldn't go to LI Who, or indeed a more local Who. Instead, I went to Manchester and I met up with Gareth Kavanagh of the Las Ogari. His huge efforts in producing a big Doctor Who celebration in Manchester for the 50th anniversary is the topic of conversation.
This is Christian Corley on the Cast Overs podcast with a K, and I am joined by Doctor Who mini con legend Gareth Kavanagh. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, Christian.
How's it going?
Yeah, good, good. Welcome to Manchester. Welcome to my island.
Thank you very much. I'll maybe get the hang of using this microphone properly in a moment as well. You are a maverick in some ways, particularly in this way that you kind of put Doctor Who events together.
Yeah, Doctor Who events in a traditional Manchester pub is perhaps not an obvious combination, but I have proved that it works. And you know, Doctor Who fans we're all in the same Venn diagram as football fanatics, as train spotters, as all sorts of groups of other people who come together. The pub is just the canvas. We just put the stuff on, people come. We make the internet real.
Okay, you and you know that, from that, let's go into what we're really going to talk about today, and this is your big Who at 50.
It is, yeah. This is something that's been in the planning for quite a while, and really is Manchester's love letter to Doctor Who. So it's 30 events, 2 weeks, 4 venues, loads of great stuff that you can only get here in Manchester. So if you're waiting for an earthly child to come to London, it will never happen.
Why would some people, possibly in the southeast or southwest, might ask, why would Manchester want to write a love letter to Doctor Who?
Well, it's where I live. But no, Doctor Who has a real home in Manchester, because Manchester, for starters, has always been a powerhouse of television since the great days of the Bernsteins and Granada. A lot of the guys who brought back Doctor Who, including Russell himself, got their first breaks in Manchester. So Russell's first job was Why Don't You, which was produced from BBC Manchester over the road. Then moves on to Granada, and Granada was doing all that great drama in the, you know, not just Coronation Street, but you know, all of the fabulous drama output that was coming out of Granada at the time. So Russell cuts his teeth there, Gareth Roberts cuts his teeth there, Paul Cornell spent a couple of years working in Granada and scripted one episode of Coronation Street, then left. It's the episode where Deirdre meets John Lindsay for the first time.
Was he he was the airline pilot, wasn't he?
Airline pilot with two families. Very believable. And in fact, he wasn't even an airline pilot. He sold ties.
Oh, that's right.
In the airport. It was quite funny, actually. That was quite credible, actually. So a lot of these guys started off here. And, you know, Manchester is where these guys cut their teeth. They got their first breaks in the TV industry while all the time plotting the return of Doctor Who. So Gareth Roberts would put Doctor Who references into Emmerdale all the time. Yeah. I think he called the IT firm the think tank. And I think there's lots of Blake Seven and Doctor Who references. So that's where it started. But lest us forget that the return of Doctor Who was plotted from Russell T. Davies's study table half a mile up the road from here in Victoria Park, right, in his house. And this is where he lived and crafted it. This is where all the key meetings were. This is where Eccleston was cast over the road. This is where they met with John Sim when they offered him the role of the Master, which was over, you know, over in the Malmaison Hotel. So Doctor Who is, you know, it stakes a claim, but really we love it. And I think it would be a shame if I didn't use my position at the helm of a great pub to help bring us all together and do something really special.
Okay. Now, you have a huge programme of events, which we will link to in the podcast show notes.
Yeah, a mind-meltingly huge.
Yes. So I'm not going to ask you to list through each of them, but what do you have that really stands out for you? What are you really looking forward to?
Oh, well, it has to be Waris Hussain. First time he's been done an event in Manchester. You know, the creator, alongside Verity Lambert and Sidney Newman, of Doctor Who. The man who was there, who helped shape the roots, who were there casting it, who put this crazy idea together, who worked with all those amazing sound designers. Everything that we take for granted, you know, is in those first shows, and he does a phenomenal job. A real gent, a real raconteur, looking in remarkable shape, considering that he was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But he was only 23 when he did it, so he's that's great. And after his talk, he's going to stay around and see the premiere of our live version of Unearthly Child. Okay. So, as I've said to the guys, no pressure.
He knows all about that then. Has he had any involvement?
No, he's given us, he's intrigued by it. Right. He's intrigued, he thinks it's a bit crazy, but he's intrigued by it, and he sent us his very best wishes. Okay. So, fingers crossed. So that's great. The other thing that gets me really, we're getting a lot of good response, gets me very excited, is the night we're doing in Canal Street, which is looking at links between Coronation Street and Doctor Who.
Okay.
With Phil Collinson. Again, an important voice in both shows, the only man to have produced both. Again, he's, you know, another great Manchester link. You know, a lot of the seeds of Doctor Who coming back have been laid for years, you know, and Phil was script editor on Queer as Folk, of course, with Russell, which was really the original love letter to Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. Great show. So Phil's going to be there to host an evening with myself and the Fiction Stroker, and okay, the great Manchester blogger. And we're going to be talking about both shows and showing some really lovely rare clips. So we've got Mary Tam in there, as she's one of the, I think she's part of the Ogden family,
yeah,
in the early 70s. We've got Liz Sladen in there, goes on a double date with Pat Phoenix in the early 70s. We've got, and we've got a doctor, Patrick Troughton, if we can find the clip. So that's great. You, yeah, know, that's that. So that is Manchester and all our big cultural institutions all clashing. And ITV are lovely, and they've really got behind it, and they've given us lots of resources, and they recognise that, you know, this is worth celebrating.
Okay. Would you how would you feel about a Doctor Who set in Manchester?
Well, I asked Russell T. Davies about this when I met him about 8 years ago, because Chris Eccleston had famously said he wanted to do a Doctor Who set in Salford, mm-hmm, in the 60s. And Russell wasn't at all keen, it must be said, on the idea.
Fear Her could have been set in Manchester. It could have been anywhere, couldn't it?
It could have been anywhere, but I suppose I actually don't mind it being mostly in London. Because I think that when people, because it's so big abroad, and let's be honest, when people think about Englishness, what they're thinking about from abroad, I think, is Londonness. Mm. So setting it in London, I think, is a good move. In Manchester, yeah. We haven't had much in Manchester. I think Paul Cornell did a missing adventure with vampires called Goth Opera, which is set in Manchester. Yeah. But I can't say it really adds much to the flavour of it. You know.
I think there's one in Middlesbrough as well.
Oh, well, there's certainly there's a comic strip, which is Evening's Empire.
Right.
Richard Piers Rayner, who is from Middlesbrough, brilliant artist. It was him who drew The Road to Perdition.
Right.
So, yeah, so the borough is in there.
Yeah.
Nice piece, actually. But, yeah, so Doctor Who in Manchester. Yeah, Chris obviously floated it. I don't think it got very far. And I remember Russell categorically ruling it out at the time, saying, no, we wouldn't go and film in Manchester. Why would we? He says, it'd be rather nice because I'd get a lie in, but that's not a good enough reason to bring them to Manchester. So.
Okay.
We'll see.
Okay, so beyond Warris Hussein and the live performance, if someone maybe wasn't able to make it to that, but they really wanted to, and what would be your without sort of like criticize, obviously don't criticize your other babies, but what's the other highlight? What do you expect to be really really popular other than that?
Ooh, let me see. There's so much varied stuff. It's I think the Art of Doctor Who event is going to be very interesting because we've got Adrian Salmon and the excellent Martin Geraghty fresh off Hunters of the Burning Stone, which I think is the best strip they've done in years.
Yeah.
And to me, that sets the bar very high for Day of the Doctor. I think it's a wonderful strip. So he's there to talk about it, and we'll have a few special guests. And if I do say so myself, there will be a sneak preview of the much anticipated Vault Vault 3.
Ooh.
And you've got to be there to see it. So there'll be just a little, I'll have a little chat about Vault Vault, and we will exclusive Comic Con style preview of some bits for that, which is still happening. I'm always asked every week, when's it coming back? Well, it is still happening, dear listeners, but it is taking its time.
Okay.
Poor Dan McDade is having to fit in a 28-page epic strip in between all his paid work, and he's doing a sterling job with it. It's great, but obviously things like that take as long as they take, but it will be great.
Okay. Right, well, whilst we're here talking about the 50th anniversary, and I'm just distracted listening by some stunning artwork on the walls in this on the walls of the Lasso Gary in here, which they've had a bit of a change in the decor.
Yep, the Adrian Salmon stuff is down, but we've got some really weird Hieronymus Bosch-style prints.
Yeah.
And these ladies here in the corner, and I don't know why we're doing this, because this really isn't very audio-friendly. These are portrait pictures of ordinary women from the 60s, and I picked up a stack of them from a photographer at a car boot sale. Each of these is a name and a person behind them. They're fascinating, and these are proper women from the 60s in sort of, you know, quite nice sort of portrait shots done by a proper artiste. I wonder who they are.
They're very hairdresser window, the portraits, aren't they?
Yeah, they are a bit. I mean, that's such a good beehive in the top.
Top.
I think you should take pictures.
I think I have to,
and we'll put them on, yeah. Mrs. Beehive, I quite like. And the groovy woman, bottom left.
Bottom left, yeah.
Yeah, that's a real...
Is that a photo?
Yeah, they're all photos.
Yeah, that's
very iconic. So we're going to have to recreate some of these hairstyles, really, for An Unearthly Child, because we need Barbara.
I think you're going to. Yeah.
I think there's Susan there, maybe, in the bottom left, and Barbara has to be the top, really, doesn't she? Top right.
Yeah. Okay. So we've covered how much you enjoyed the Doctor Who magazine strip for the 50th anniversary. But what I was also going to ask you before we wrap up is, what are you really looking for? What is defining the 50th anniversary for you? I know we haven't got to the Day of the Doctor or An Adventure in Space and Time, but what do you really fancy the most, or what have you enjoyed the most?
It's An Adventure in Space and Time. I have seen some shots which look absolutely stunning from that, including one very nice surprise, which I won't spoil for anyone, but it's brilliant. It looks so good. Damn that Mark Gatiss for being so thorough. We were originally going to do a Hartnell piece for drama. That had been in planning for a year, and we wanted to do a piece on Hartnell in the Panto.
Yeah.
Which would have been wonderful, based on Richard Bicknell's great research. And it's all in there, apparently. Right. You know, that's in there. Then I said, okay, well, I think we should do the famous Chinese meal, where Sidney Newman takes out Warris and Verity after the calamitous first shoot of the pilot and says, right, you tell me why I shouldn't sack the two of you.
Yeah.
I thought, nope, that's it then. I said, oh, okay, why don't we do Joanna Spicer, who wants to cancel the programme, and Verity Lambert has to go in and bat for the programme and persuade them that they can do it on the budget. And there's all sorts of clever use of words like amortization, which everyone nods sagely at, but no one knows what it means. And yeah, that's in there as well. So we thought, okay, let's just sit back and enjoy it. So yeah, that I will enjoy the most, I think. And I think it sounds great. Everyone who's seen it said it's great. And I think that's the highlight.
Excellent. Gareth Cavanagh, you continue to pop up on Outcast Derby's podcast with a K, and may you continue to do so.
Well, I do like to think I'm like one of them unit semi-regulars that they bring in every now and again. You know, bigger than Corporate Bell, but not as big as Captain Mike Yates.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
If you could go to Manchester, you'd be there now, wouldn't you? Waiting, chomping at the bit to go at these things.
I would.
Yeah, so would I. I'm particularly interested by the Warris Hussain interview and the restaging of the first episode of Doctor Who. I think that's a clever idea, but totally.
Has he found
typical.
A console yet?
I'm not sure if he's found a console yet. I didn't ask him on the day, but I'd only advertised it on the day before. I may have asked him on the day. We talked about a lot of things last week, which unfortunately I can't share with you, dear listener. But there you go. Missing episodes, what? Yes. So, let's move on, before this turns into a Frankie Howard impersonation, to this week's recommendations. James, you've kind of had a kind of recommendation, haven't you? You want just to recommend Sylvester McCoy?
Yeah, I think I just want to recommend Sylvester McCoy. I think that's my recommendation.
Okay. Brian, you are not recommending an individual.
I'm not recommending an individual, but I will recommend the work of any of the four that I have interviewed or spoke with this weekend to no end, because I think they deserve it, all of it, anything, because I also spoke to Ian McNeice about Doc Martin.
Good man.
Good, yes.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. And I love the series, and I love his character, you know? So, I mean, I would definitely recommend, and I don't just mean the Doctor Who, I mean the extended work of all of these actors,
yes,
and writers, because they've all done beautiful things. Mm. And I, as a matter of fact, you know, I learned Ian McNeice not only played Churchill in Doctor Who, but he's played him in two other different productions.
That's right.
You know, and we spoke about the differences between those characters. And so, you know, I'm fascinated by this concept, and I'd like to see all of these things now. So definitely pick up anything by any of them, because these gentlemen deserve it for sure.
Okay, then. Well, in that case, I am going to recommend that you, dear listener, if you're in the UK or you can make it to Manchester, you get yourself to at least one of the events that have been held at La Sogari, the Fab Cafe, or any of the other venues involved, and just enjoy the 50th anniversary. We will be back next week on a similar day, on a similar time, in a similar podcast, but with different content, but hopefully the same trio of barely legible hosts. Until then, it's goodbye. Not sure where I was going with that outro.
No, nor we.
Maybe you should just pre-record the outros as well.